Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, for the second year, a Google-backed company is planning to release millions of mosquitoes in Fresno and Clovis to hopefully reduce mosquito populations. We'll hear how the project is working and why some people are still concerned. Plus, we'll go behind the scenes at the event that brought the world's top surfers to Lemoore. Later in the program, we'll learn about a new exhibit at a valley museum, or better put, a mountain museum, at the Central Sierra Historical Society at Shaver Lake. They're looking at the epic die-off of trees across the Central Sierra. And we'll talk with author Howell Hurst about his new book, I Can't Hear the Drums Anymore, Fragments from Life. We begin, though, with the world of politics. The six leading candidates for governor will debate tonight in San Jose as vote-by-mail ballots arrive for the June 5th primary election. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler has this snapshot of where the race stands as voting gets underway.
Democrat Gavin Newsom has emerged in polls as the frontrunner. He says his career is in both the public and private sectors shape what he'd bring to the governor's office.
A willingness to take risks, a willingness to be bold, a willingness to get out front on issues, a willingness to tackle vexing problems by trying to solve them, not manage them.
As mayor of San Francisco, he defied the law to marry same-sex couples. As lieutenant governor, he pushed gun control and recreational marijuana ballot measures. Now he's making the uphill battle for single-payer health care a core part of his campaign.
I believe very passionately in this debate, and I'm going to lean into it aggressively.
Behind Newsom, three other Democrats and two Republicans are jockeying for second place. That's because the top two June primary finishers, regardless of political party, advanced to the November general election.
Let's make the Golden State golden once more.
At the California Republican Party convention over the weekend, businessman John Cox slammed the state's Democratic leaders.
They've gone way over to the left. They've opened up the middle for us. They have made this state virtually unaffordable for working people.
Cox is a lawyer, accountant, and venture capitalist who isn't afraid to fund his own campaigns. His previous efforts at ballot measures, Congress, Senate, and even president have all flailed. But now he's backed by much of the party establishment as its best hope for a top two primary finish.
Let's take back California!
The other leading Republican, Assemblyman Travis Allen, hasn't raised a lot of money, and polls show him struggling to catch the leading candidates. But he's lit a fire among conservatives, Tea Party groups, and Trump supporters who love his Trump-esque tone.
We have been the silent supermajority. We have been the forgotten Californians. But I'll tell you right now, ladies and gentlemen, we will be silent no longer!
Back on the Democratic side, there's Antonio Villaraigosa, who's had two very different political careers. As California Assembly Speaker in the late 1990s, he fought for liberal goals on issues from health care to guns. As mayor of Los Angeles during the Great Recession, he battled labor unions on education, furloughs, and pensions. Now, he's campaigning as a pro-business progressive, fighting for low-income, minority, and moderate Californians.
We got the Golden State, the only state with its own dream, the California dream. And I think we need to restore the luster to that dream.
John Chung believes he can strike a sweet spot in California politics, a progressive who's fiscally prudent. The soft-spoken state treasurer, who previously served two terms as controller, says he's the candidate who can responsibly achieve liberal goals like single-payer health care while keeping California financially sound.
I think there's a crystal-clear difference in track record, openness, transparency, and honesty as to the state's values and how do you pay for the state's values.
Chung also calls himself the no-drama candidate who won't embarrass the state, a not-so-subtle jab at some of his rivals. And then there's Delaine Easton, the only female candidate among the leaders, and arguably the most liberal. The former state schools chief and assembly member says she has the brass backbone to not just go along and get along at the state capitol.
It's a shame that we have a two-thirds majority of Democrats in both houses and all eight constitutional officers are Democrats, but we're not moving the needle on a host of really important issue areas.
Such as rent control, fracking, and education. One of these six people will likely lead the biggest state in the nation. And the next month until the June primary, starting with tonight's debate, could be pivotal. In a state as blue as California, a Democrat versus Republican runoff in November might be over before it starts. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You can hear the California gubernatorial debate tonight live on this station at 6:30. Summer is approaching in the San Joaquin Valley, and that means it's not only the season for sunscreen and paletas, but also mosquitoes, something local authorities are working on. For the last 2 years, the Fresno area has been the site of an experimental mosquito control program, and this year it's back again. FM89's Carrie Klein reports on the project's latest scaled-up season and why the technique appears to be working.
If you're expecting the ice cream truck on these hot May days, you may be disappointed if you're one of the few neighborhoods where this van rolls up. What's in the van?
Lots and lots of mosquitoes. Male mosquitoes.
Steve Mulligan is director of the Fresno Consolidated Mosquito Abatement District.
Should we walk over?
Yeah. And he says this white, high-top Mercedes van is part of a project called Debug Fresno.
We are releasing male mosquitoes in three neighborhoods in Fresno County to implement and evaluate a new innovative mosquito control strategy against an invasive mosquito species.
Throughout 2018, vans like these will be releasing millions upon millions of male mosquitoes in three neighborhoods in Fresno and Clovis. It's a kind of pest control paradox.
We're hoping by sustaining these releases over a period of time, we can reduce the local population of biting females.
And Mulligan and his partners believe it's working. After a small test in 2016 and Debug's debut in 2017, preliminary results suggest the biting female population dropped by two-thirds. So it's back for another year in the Fancher Creek area of Fresno and the Harlan Ranch and Loma Vista neighborhoods of Clovis. But Mulligan says, don't worry, Debug's all-male mosquitoes shouldn't bother you.
It's only female mosquitoes that bite. Male mosquitoes cannot bite.
The Fresno area is home to close to 30 mosquito species. Most don't transmit disease, but that's recently changed. First, with a mosquito that began carrying West Nile virus in the early 2000s, and with a different species even more recently.
We have this new invasive mosquito now since 2013 in California. It's the Aedes aegypti mosquito.
Aedes aegypti mosquitoes are more aggressive than native ones, but there's a much bigger reason the species is concerning.
This is the primary vector of some very serious diseases, including dengue, chikungunya, Zika virus, and historically yellow fever, which really decimated populations in the United States, centuries ago.
These diseases affect hundreds of Californians each year. And although most cases are believed to be picked up internationally, Mulligan wants to prevent local transmission here. So we found some project partners to help. A Kentucky company called MosquitoMate and Verily, a research and development company owned by Google parent company Alphabet. The partners provide Mulligan's district with sterile mosquitoes. They've been injected with Wolbachia, a bacteria that occurs naturally in most insect species, but not Aedes aegypti. The mosquitoes are grown in Verily's San Francisco lab. Senior scientist Jacob Crawford says the genders are then meticulously sorted so that only males are released.
Those males go out into the environment and mate with females, and so any females that mate with our males cannot have viable offspring.
This is not genetic modification. In fact, this technology in a different mosquito species has officially been recognized as a biopesticide by the EPA. Fresno may have been the Debug program's first test site, but Debug is far from the first to test this so-called sterile insect technique. One of the technique's earliest demonstrations took place just after World War II, and not on mosquitoes, but on an insect that harms livestock. Fresno State entomologist Jorge Gonzalez says today, the technique is commonplace in other insects. It's used in California to control fruit flies and a cotton pest called the pink bollworm.
So the technique is simple, is really beautiful. It really works.
What is new is the use of Wolbachia. Those earlier programs sterilized insects using different technology, like radiation. Gonzalez says Wolbachia can be used to control mosquitoes in other ways, too. One is to infect both males and females with the bacteria. Then the population wouldn't diminish, it would adapt, but it would still get at the root problem.
When they are highly infected with Wolbachia, the female becomes a very lousy transmitter of dengue.
This technique is already being used to control dengue fever in parts of Africa. For now, Debug Fresno is only operating in 3 test neighborhoods. But if it's successful, partners hope it could someday help eliminate Aedes aegypti here. But one thing it should never eliminate is the ice cream truck. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
So that story was all about Debug Fresno and what that program is, but we also think it's important to talk about what Debug Fresno isn't. There are a lot of concerns out there about this project. We've reported on it for a couple of years now, and we always got comments, people saying, what's going on here? Why are they releasing more mosquitoes into the area? That seems like a bad idea. And things maybe could go wrong, people asking those things as well. Our Carrie Klein has collected some of those questions, and she's here to talk through them with us. Carrie, welcome again.
Hi, Joe.
So there are a lot of people that are worked up about this. Why are they concerned?
Well, I think there's a lot of uncertainty and mistrust. I think those are really common responses to this project. In a way, I think that's understandable. You know, there is a certain squeamishness in response to animals that are raised in a lab, even mosquitoes, which not many people, you know, have much affection for in the first place. But also these mosquitoes are often referred to as technology, which has a certain cognitive dissonance to it. And so I think that people are right to question this project. And the questions that I've heard are actually what led me to put together this reporting this week. But there are answers to their questions.
So let's go through. We've sort of collected thematically what a lot of these different questions and concerns are. And maybe the most common one is Debug Fresno is releasing all these mosquitoes. Isn't that a bad idea? That sounds like it would lead to more mosquito bites.
Right. That is absolutely the most common misconception that that Steve Mulligan says he deals with. Steve Mulligan of the Fresno Consolidated Mosquito Abatement District. You know, people in these test areas see these mosquitoes, they're afraid they're going to get bitten more. Some say they are bitten more, or they believe they are bitten more, but the fact is that only female mosquitoes bite of any species, and the mosquitoes released here should all be male.
So I have to ask, how does one determine or separate out the genders of tiny little mosquitoes?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's why I say they should all be male, because there is a very small likelihood that there could be some females that make it through, even though that's, you know, not the intention at all. So there are a couple different ways that they sort through these. And I've been told by various people involved that they're really meticulous about it. So there's one way where you can do mechanical separation. Males and females are different sizes. You can separate them visually that way. They also hatch at different times. And so there's a certain point at which you can just get, you know, you can figure out from how early they've hatched if they're male or females. There's also a computer algorithm involved. Because, of course, one of the companies involved here is owned by Google parent company Alphabet. So, of course, there would be some computer work involved here. But Jacob Crawford, who's with Verily, that company owned by Google parent company Alphabet, you know, he says that this is really meticulous. Here's a little bit of a quote from Crawford on that.
We have extremely stringent QC processes before any of the males leave the factory or our headquarters here in South San Francisco. So we believe the probability of anything like that happening is extremely low.
So there's not one person in there just counting, oh, one mosquito here, one mosquito there.
One could imagine that couldn't happen when you're dealing with millions and millions and millions of mosquitoes. But of course, you know, this isn't just lip service. It is in their best interest to get this right because they want this project to go well. They want to commercialize it. So, you know, But there are still likely to be some very small error bars here.
So the other big comment that we see quite often or question about the project involves GMO, and that's genetically modified organisms, something that's a touchstone out there for a lot of different people on different sides of the issue. We hear it all the time with crops and things like that. Are these mosquitoes GMO, Carrie?
They are not. That is a myth. These are not genetically modified organisms. This, you know, and you hear the term Frankenbug, Frankenmonster. You hear all these sorts of, you know, really... really polarizing terms that are they're just incorrect. So this technology involves no genetic changes. There's no insertion of genetic material from one organism into the genetic material of the other. The way this works is that these mosquitoes are infected with a bacteria called Wolbachia. It is a naturally occurring bacteria. It's actually found in about 2/3 of insect species, including many other mosquitoes. And scientists get Wolbachia into these mosquitoes by injecting it into their eggs. So there are no genetic changes whatsoever. However, that being said, there is at least one company out there that has created genetically modified mosquitoes. It's a British company called Oxitec, but it is no way involved in this project. And they were approved by the EPA for a field trial in the Florida Keys a few years ago, but residents there wouldn't allow it, and it so never went forward. So, in fact, this company, as of yet, has not actually been able to field test any of their mosquitoes in the U.S. because of concerns about GMOs. But that is not what's happening here.
So continuing on that Frankenbug theme, another common question is, well, you know, these could mutate in some way in the wild. Why is that a concern that's maybe not as borne out by the science?
Yeah, so that one is also almost entirely false. So the term mutate refers to genetic changes. And so there are no mutations that are going to happen here because of this project. The only reason that I say it's almost entirely false is because mutations happen all the time naturally. So, you know, that's one way that organisms evolve and adapt. And so that's going to happen slowly, slowly, slowly over time, regardless of what happens I've done to these mosquitoes. But, you know, there have been no genetic changes in these Debug Fresno mosquitoes. So there's no reason to believe this project alone could cause any mutations.
So you're talking about them adapting. What if they grow and start to adapt to this Wolbachia? Is that a concern?
Yeah, so that is also a question that a lot of people have, and that's a really interesting one. That one is also mostly false, but there are some caveats. So the only way that these mosquitoes could grow to adapt to Wolbachia is if some critical mass of females with Wolbachia make it into these mosquito releases. And so once again, as we've covered, you know, that's the intention is to really not let that happen. But that's important because this experiment only works if a male with Wolbachia mates with a female without it. And so that's why they're really focusing on only releasing males with Wolbachia. But if the females also have Wolbachia, they are able to create offspring who also carry it, and they would go on reproducing. And so that's why they're really careful about that. Now, what's interesting about that is that should females actually make it into their releases, and should Wolbachia become common in these Aedes aegypti here in this area, this tool would not be as effective in controlling the population, but it would still be a positive because Aedes aegypti with Wolbachia don't transmit diseases as well. That's kind of a confusing point. So here I am getting some clarification on that from Jorge Gonzalez. He's an entomologist at Fresno State who's not involved at all with Debug Fresno, but is familiar with how it works. But what that means is, you know, they're only releasing males right now.
Right now they're only
ostensibly
releasing males.
But should they accidentally allow some females in those releases, and should, you know, the population here develop more Wolbachia inside of it, that should still hopefully help to control the diseases that they could otherwise transmit.
Yes, that's more or less the idea. That's not what they are doing, but if by any chance that happened, it is still a good way to diminish the problem.
And Joe, this technique of establishing Wolbachia in the entire population, it is already being used in Africa to control dengue fever.
So there's also concerns about pollination. What are those about?
Right. So people worry that that by disrupting the species, either they're disrupting pollination, or if we were to wipe out Aedes aegypti, that could reduce pollination in the area. That's a myth. However, mosquitoes are wild pollinators. That's a little known fact. But we should remember three things here. So Aedes aegypti mosquitoes are invasive. They only arrived around 5 years ago. So an entire ecosystem existed before they got here. There were lots of pollinators. There are 30 other mosquito species that exist in this region, and they're going to pollinate just fine, even if Aedes aegypti were somehow knocked out of the ecosystem altogether. And the third point is it's estimated that almost two-thirds of all insect species contain Wolbachia already, naturally, without human intervention. So this species is not introducing anything that's not already out there in the wild.
What about the food chain and concerns about any other organisms that might consume a Wolbachia-tainted male mosquito?
Right. People are really worried about that, about this bacteria somehow harming other animals. Well, that's another myth. So Wolbachia don't affect other species. In fact, they really only affect insects. So I'm going to let Steve Mulligan of the Fresno Consolidated Mosquito Abatement District take this one.
Wolbachia is a naturally occurring bacterium that is found in numerous insect species, including some butterflies, some dragonflies, and several mosquito species, including mosquitoes that we have in this area. So any predators that they're already being exposed to eating insects with Wolbachia.
So frogs, bats, birds, lizards, when they eat these mosquitoes, they're not ingesting anything they can't handle, and they're not in turn passing anything harmful up to their predators.
And this last one is my favorite one. If Wolbachia can sterilize mosquitoes, could not Wolbachia sterilize people?
Absolute myth. So once again, Wolbachia, it only affects insects, you know, in these various reproductive ways. But there's multiple reasons for this. I mean, first, well, as I said, Wolbachia doesn't affect humans. It will not sterilize us, cannot. But also, only female mosquitoes bite. And remember that if this project is working properly, it's only releasing male mosquitoes. And so we wouldn't even come into contact with mosquitoes with Wolbachia in them. But however, if you still don't believe either of those points, many other mosquito species do carry Wolbachia already in our environment, including many that bite humans. So we're already exposed to it from other mosquito species.
Fascinating work, Carrie. Thanks so much for giving us a new insight into those bugs flying around.
Yeah, happy to be here.
This is Valley Edition. Over 5,000 people came to the Central Valley this weekend to watch the first World Surf League team competition live. The event took place at a world-class wave pool in, of all places, Lemoore. FM89's Laura Tsutsui reports that some think Kelly Slater's Surf Ranch is the next frontier for the sport.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Chris Estep loves to watch surfing. He says he and his wife watch the competitions whenever they can, but always from their home in Fresno via live stream video.
Most of the competitions are nowhere near us. The other competitions will be like a two-week window. If the conditions are right, the competition will run. If it's not, then it won't. Just timing that right has never made sense.
But for the first time this weekend, he got to watch some of the world's best surfers compete in person at a location where the conditions are always right.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah, I have to force myself not to use expletives on there.
Estep was one of the 5,000 attendees from all over the world who came out to Lemoore to watch the World Surf League Founders Cup competition. This weekend held many firsts for the league. The first public event held at Kelly Slater Surf Ranch, the first team competition, and the first look at what the future of competitive surfing might be. The league called the Founders Cup a specialty event. Surfers have always competed individually. For this event, athletes were grouped into co-ed teams of 3 men and 2 women. The teams represented USA, Brazil, Australia, Europe, and the world. Kelly Slater captained Team USA. He's someone that many call the greatest surfer of all time. Slater has won the World Surf League Championship 11 times, and his career spans over 25 years. He spent the last 10 developing this wave pool in the middle of California. Slater says its location in Lemoore just happened to work out.
We were just looking for a place that had ample land and water and the right permitting and access to the amount of energy we needed to run the wave.
Like much of the Central Valley, Lemoore is a center for agriculture. To see surfers on 6-foot waves there is surreal. Kelly Slater worked with a team of engineers and surfers to create this phenomenon.
The real idea, the ultimate idea is to make a perfect wave, which I believe we've done, and we can evolve that technology into something else, you know, into another different blueprint of a wave, whether it's for beginner or advanced.
Artificial wave pools aren't particularly new technology, but wave pools that are ideal for surfing have been elusive until now. Slater's man-made lake itself is the length of 7 football fields. The waves are powered by a 200-ton shovel of metal that's pulled the length of the pool, pushing water over a fake reef designed right into the floor of the lake. The result is consistent. Surfers get a 45-second ride and a wave perfect for performing. Slater says this wave pool will even the playing field for surfers.
In terms of luck in the ocean, you know, you're dealing with Mother Nature, and this person or that person might get the good wave. This eliminates that, so it comes down to more of a performance thing.
World Surf League CEO Sophie Goldschmidt agrees that this technology will change surfing.
I don't think surfing will ever be the same again. I think we're going to learn a lot. This is a test event in many ways. We've never done anything like this before, and this is a prototype technology.
The Surf League has already bought the rights to the Kelly Slater Wave Company, and there are plans to build the next pool in Tokyo in anticipation of the sport's debut at the 2020 Olympics. Some are concerned that surfing in a pool with machine-made waves is not in the spirit of the sport. They argue that part of surfing is dealing with the challenge and unpredictability of Mother Nature. Goldschmidt says this technology isn't a departure from the ocean, but is something that could benefit the sport.
This is additive to surfing in the ocean. This doesn't take away from it. We're fortunate. This isn't an either-or. We can have both. The ocean is still super important to us. We'll still have the majority of our events in the ocean. But this technology allows us to go to markets that we would never be able to go to otherwise.
Most surfers at the event agreed. The wave pool is one of a kind. Kolohe and Dino surfed for Team USA this weekend. The 24-year-old ranked 7th in the world last year. He says riding these waves feels incredible.
Yeah, it's just super, like, different because you're just in the middle of the desert. You're driving out here. It's like, whoa, this is so weird. And then you get here and it's like paradise for a surfer. It's perfect waves and obviously a really nice setup.
By the end of the Founders Cup this weekend, Team World came out on top with surfers from South Africa, Japan, New Zealand, and French Polynesia. The competition didn't affect the athletes' standings in the league, but it was a taste of what might be to come for surfing, and it could include a generation of Central Valley surfing fans. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui in Lemoore.
And stay with us here on Valley Edition in the next half of our program. We'll talk to local author Howell Hurst and learn about a new museum exhibit at a museum just outside Shaver Lake. That's all coming up here on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Over the last few years, the forests of the Sierra have been devastated with an epic tree die-off unlike any in recent memory. The combination of insects, drought, and forest management practices have resulted in a situation that has changed the appearance of our once green forest in a remarkably short period of time. A new exhibit and website at one local museum is dedicated to sharing insights into this issue. Joining us now, we have Lisa Montero, the executive director of the Central Sierra Historical Society Museum in Shaver Lake, and John Mount, who is a board member for the museum and a forester. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lisa, I want to start with you. This is several years now into this epidemic of tree mortality that we see up and down California's forested lands. What's the state of the situation right now after the last few years when we've seen so many additional trees die off?
Right now, the last number that we've received is that there are over 129 million dead trees in the Sierra Nevada forests. What we wanted to do with our museum and through this website was bring awareness to that. Up in Shaver, we live and work there, and we feel we see it on a day-to-day basis, but we don't feel like it had the information that people needed to kind of find out how this affects people, not just in our area, but all over California. And so the website was created to kind of fill that void. We had visitors coming to the museum that thought the trees were changing colors because of fall. And so we knew we had to address that and try to educate our visitors on site and also through the website.
We'll talk more about that exhibit in a moment, but I want to turn to John Mount, who is a forester and on the board of the museum. John, how is the tree die-off faring right now? Is it accelerating still, or is it beginning to wane as we had last year, a nearly historic rain and snowfall year in some areas at least? Has the die-off in any way tapered off, or is it still accelerating?
No, it's definitely tapered off. It's following the normal natural progression of things in a natural situation where it goes up and down, just like rainfall. Some years heavy rainfall, some years not. And that's what happened. And there's so many trees that were dead that the insects had no place to go, really. So there was an extreme die-off of the insects themselves.
To someone who's not a trained forester or someone who's really a naturalist who spends a lot of time in the mountains, maybe this goes up to Shaver Lake a few times for recreation in the summer or up to a ski at China Peak in the winter, they see the tree die off and the forest sort of looks all the same. It's just all one sort of tree to the casual observer. But I know there's a lot of different species. Are there particular species that are more affected and faring worse than others?
That is very correct, and that is a real problem. A lot of people, like yourself, saying go up casually, and they still see trees there, so they think, oh, this wasn't a big deal. But the fact is there was way too many trees, and the insects reduced the pine species, and so the species of fir and cedar are the ones that are left, and those aren't really the natural species that should be in the area to maintain the wildlife component of our natural resources.
Now, with the dead and dying trees, you mentioned wildlife. Does the wildlife in the area benefit in some way? Do they use these dead trees as habitat?
There are, again, just like nature, everything functions in a different little ecosystem or a niche within an ecosystem. So there are some species of wildlife that are benefiting because of all the insects. That's what they eat. But there's others that need cover, need green pine needles for their nests and so forth, that are going to suffer. So some species will expand dramatically. Other species will drop dramatically. And that will change over the next 50 years. It'll go back and forth.
For the last century or so, people who have made their way up to Shaver Lake have ascended up the steep cliffs there. People today take the four-lane highway up 168, and you get to Cressman's Lodge there. And all of a sudden, you start to see the conifers appear at that point. Is that line going to move up the mountain?
What's sad about that, it has already moved dramatically. You talk about 50 years ago, that's about, I got here about 60 years ago, and the line of trees has already moved up dramatically. It used to be you would see the conifers 1,000 foot lower than Cressman's. And now with this epidemic and die-off, that line has moved even higher. And it's because of human interaction and human mistakes on how we manage our forests.
We're talking with John Mount from the Central Sierra Historical Society Museum in Shaver Lake. They have a new exhibit called A Forest Without Trees. It's also a website. Lisa Montero, the executive director of the museum, is here as well. Lisa, tell me more about what you aim to convey with this exhibit and the website.
We just really want to be able to educate those that visit the site and the museum about what is happening here and how it affects them on a larger scale. The website came about, we had a meeting and we were talking about creating this exhibit because of the misinformation that was out there. And one of our Board of Trustees members, Dr. John Bogart, suggested making a documentary. And as we began filming for the website, or for this documentary, it became apparent there was so much information and it was ever changing. And if we created just one documentary, it wasn't really going to have that long lasting effect. And so we made the decision to create this website and have an exhibit in the museum that talks about the bark beetle as well. And we're able to add content. We have videos that have interviews with homeowners, representatives from the Forest Service. We talk to politicians. We really just want to have a great cross-sectional view of what's happening here so people can get the most information.
You mentioned misinformation. What sorts of misinformation are out there about this, in your view?
Well, I think it's easy to just place blame and say, oh, this is the fault of the bark beetle, or this is because of the drought. But really, within our group, we talk about it being a perfect storm. Obviously, mismanagement plays a huge role. If you're in an overcrowded forest, there's more competition between the resources for the trees. That creates unhealthy atmosphere. And that's really what created this event. It wasn't just bark beetle. It wasn't just drought. It was all of these things happening at the same time in a very overcrowded forest.
John, today Shaver Lake is a great source of recreation for all of California, really people coming from all over to see the wonderful sights and enjoy the water there. But it was created back in the early 20th century as a logging operation. Today it's used to generate electricity. But when we think back at the way that area has changed, was all of that area logged at one point? How old is the forest that's dying right now?
There's actually two layers. Southern California Edison owns the land right around Shaver Lake, and that area was completely logged off by 1914. Between 1891 and 1914, the old Shaver Mill, the entire land was stripped. So the forest on Edison lands is quite a bit younger than the forest on the Sierra National Forest. So there's really two age stands of timber there. However, the lands on Shaver Lake, Edison land, still have large trees and grew back quite nicely under good management. So those lands were not as overgrown as the surrounding national forest lands.
You mentioned management. Tell me a little more, in your view again, the issue from your perspective with regards to the Forest Service and their approach. How is it different?
Well, it's quite a bit different, and mainly because of the laws that they have to obey created by Congress. Whereas private land, we had the ability to go in and harvest timber, and most importantly is reintroduce natural fire, because that was nature's way of maintaining the forest structure with open pine-dominated forests, that which is a natural forest. By excluding fire, like the Forest Service does, and most everybody has done, that has allowed the forest to become overgrown. That's just one of the things that Lisa was talking about with the webpage. It explains all these different things that occurred to create this catastrophe.
And for the record, the Forest Service does do some controlled burns. In fact, they just did a controlled burn in Blue Canyon, not far from Shaver Lake recently, but certainly a lot of work to do given the size of the management area there. So when people go to the website, people go to the museum, what would they see with this exhibit?
Our exhibit includes an interview with one of our board members that is also a forester. They can look at rounds of wood that show the different types of marks the beetles leave. There are different types of beetles, so we kind of break that down on which bugs are affecting which types of trees. It's kind of an assumption there's just the bark beetle and it goes after pine, but there are ips, there are other bugs that are affecting it. And so we're just trying to give people more information. If they go to the website, they're going to see all of the videos that I explained a bit earlier, as well as curriculum. So if there's a teacher anywhere from third grade through high school that wants to bring their class up to the museum, we provide curriculum and they can see how that meets state standards. And it's a really wonderful time. We have video on the site of kids, you know, pounding away at rounds of wood, trying to count how many beetles are within a round so that we can figure out how many life cycles go through each summer. And there's also related articles. So anything that's been published about this within the last 3 to 4 years, as that information comes out, we put that on the website as well. And there's a place to ask questions because we want people to feel comfortable to get the answers that they need. And we get those questions at the museum and then refer them to John or one of our other foresters.
Now, I mentioned the history of Shaver Lake a moment ago and going back to the lumber mill and the flume. You actually have a portion of the old flume at your museum. This is the exhibit we're talking about today with the Forest Without Trees. Isn't your only exhibit at the museum. Tell me about some of the other things you have.
We are actually located on almost 20 acres. And so our exhibits are both inside the museum, some more static, talking about Native Americans, logging, forestry, the history of Shaver Lake. But as we go out on the property, we have a fully functional steam donkey, which is a piece of equipment that was used to pull logs through the forest around the time that they were cutting shaver that John mentioned. We also have a fully functional powerhouse. We're the only museum in the world that has a hydroelectric powerhouse that can generate electricity and contribute that electricity to the Southern California Edison grid. We have a caboose that was used during the Big Creek project on the San Joaquin and Eastern Railroad, as well as a Mack truck. And then we have a beautiful amphitheater where we have concerts in the summer. So the property itself is, you know, this museum without walls, we like to say. And
before we go, where can people find the museum? I have a feeling a lot of people drive by and don't know it's there.
Right. So we are located in Shaver Lake at the entrance to Camp Edison, which is just between town and the lake. The address is 42642 Toll House. You can visit us on our website at sierrahistorical.org or aforestwithouttrees.com.
All right. Again, that new exhibit, A Forest Without Trees, showcasing the impact that drought, forest management practices, and the bark beetle have had on the forest in the Central Sierra. It's at the Central Sierra Historical Society Museum. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The name Howell Hurst is a familiar one to Valley Public Radio listeners. The one-time Kern County resident has several stories that aired on this station in our program Valley Writers Read. While that program is no longer on the air, Hurst has continued and he has a new book. It's called I Can't Hear the Drums Anymore, Fragments from Life, by Howell Hurst. He joins us now on the phone from his home in Pacific Grove. Howell, welcome.
Hi, Joe. How's it going?
Going very well, and thank you for joining us today. This project contains short stories that you wrote over the years. Tell me about the process of putting together this book.
These are actually just stories that came to mind over about 45 or 50 years.
You write about this book that it's hard to say whether these stories are fact or fiction. Tell me a little more about what you mean by that and where these stories come from.
You know, I've read by many writers, and I found it to be the same experience, that if you just sort of hang out and live your life, that your subconscious does something and creates stories, and all of a sudden you just get an idea. And you write the first sentence, and then somehow it just starts pouring out. So I think it really just comes from the subconscious creating the story and then giving it to you so you're conscious that it's there.
The title of the book, I Can't Hear the Drums Anymore, actually refers to one of the stories that was read on Valley Writers Read here on this station. I understand that broadcast actually got you a good bit of attention.
Well, I'm not sure, except the only thing I know, I actually even got one contact from the island of Guam, which amazed me. So I don't know how much attention it got, but it sure got one from a long ways away.
Tell me about that piece itself, which lends its name to this book. What is that story about? Give us sort of the intro or lead to that.
That one, probably more than any other story, is a very personal item. Most of these stories I have tried use fragments from life, but then to fictionalize a story, that was a very personal thing. I had my mother was a very sickly woman all her life and finally committed suicide, which is a very difficult thing to deal with, of course. And the story was about my being able to cope with that as I grew up.
How did that affect you as a young person in your life that had to have been traumatic?
You know, I think the most specific thing about it was, since she was a very cold, distant woman who was always sick, I can literally never, ever having remember being touched by her, physically touched. She was so distant. And I think in my case, it simply has probably contributed to the fact that I always stayed a bachelor all of my life. And I just sort of slightly distant and cautious toward women. And I think that was just because she was such a distant woman that as I grew up, I never quite knew how to allow myself to get extremely close to a woman for a long-term relationship, which is sort of something I've just simply acknowledged and learned to live with.
Let's go ahead and listen now to a brief excerpt from our broadcast of this story on Valley Riders Read from 2011. Again, I Can't Hear the Drums Anymore by Howell Hirst, this time read by former VPR host Terry Phillips.
There I am, the centerpiece of the photo, still no more than four, if that old, held forcibly by my father's muscled arms, the fingers of one hand gripping my jaw so hard it is bending my face into the bone structure. Tears are flowing from my eyes like lava. I cannot see her, but I know it is my mother taking the photograph. I cannot remember what happened to cause the event, what childish error I must have committed, but their vengeance appears to have been wrathful. For the rest of my youth, I feared always, especially when returning from fishing trips, when I would lay my head on his lap as he drove us home in the Chevy pickup, that my father was going to murder me. For the rest of my life, I feared that my mother would deceive me. They had conspired against me at this early age, and I felt I could never forgive them. My desire was to have had their love while they lived, of course, but that did not permit me to condone my forgiving them now that they had violated my childish trust. 24 years later, when the phone call came, my father was on the line telling me my mother had died.
That was an excerpt from a short story called I Can't Hear the Drums Anymore. It's part of a book of the same name by former Valley resident Howell Hirst. He joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Is there a cathartic element to you for writing about a situation like that or any of the other ones in this book that is writing a form of therapy for you in some way? Do you find that, or is it more of a just a creative outlet?
I think I've gotten far beyond worrying about myself as an individual person. I'm pretty comfortable with myself and my life. I think it's cathartic in that the experience of having been a person on the earth and being an American, of course, that I think I deal in my stories a great deal more with the experience of what it's like to be an ordinary American person acting like an ordinary person. And in these days, trying not to be a number in some kind of a digital jungle that's been created by government and corporation lawyers trying to sell us more things than we need.
You know, we get dozens of books sent to us a month by different authors, many of them from major publishing houses. We're going to have an author on next week talking about his new book. His last one won the Pulitzer Prize. You're an author who's going this alone, self-publishing. What is that journey like for someone who's trying to put out a book?
You know, the way I'm approaching it, I'm going primarily to private bookstores in the local area, taking the book, talking to people like the Henry Miller bookstore at Big Sur, and it seems like most of them are going to allow the book to come in to let me put up a little point of purchase poster telling who I am and what the book is about. And then otherwise, just one by one, people are starting to hear about it. And I'm just going to let it happen the way it happens. Just take it easy and keep trying to get the book out there.
Yeah, we had a poet on this program a few weeks ago from Fresno, and he was talking about the process of trying to submit manuscripts to publishers. And he said he sent off something like 25 different submissions and each time got a rejection. How do you look at trying to get attention when there's so many other authors out there all seeking for a limited market share? Especially as Americans are reading less and less, even with the advent of ebooks and things like that.
I think you have to approach it as a symptom of the problems the country is having today, the corporatization of everything. There's an article in the New York Times today that I read that says Barnes & Noble is about to go down the tubes. The American public does have a hard time reading literature anymore, and the big publishers are only interested, for the most part, in some sort of stories that can become blockbusters And by definition, those become almost formulas. And if you can't write or don't choose to write in the formula that people have gotten used to hearing of a rather simplistic kind of story, you can only look for the small handful of people who, how can you put it, still want to read something that they can get more involved in.
We're talking with Howell Hurst here on Valley Public Radio today. His new book is called I Can't Hear the Drums Anymore, Fragments from Life. Howell is an author who used to live in Kern County, now lives on the Central Coast, and has this new book out. The title of the book draws its name from one of the stories he read on our air a few years ago. How your resume is rich in a lot of different jobs and things, but it starts out with 5 years in the U.S. Army, where you rose to the rank of captain. How much of your time in the armed forces influenced your writing and the stories in this book?
I think the influence as an Army intelligence officer was to learn to be very skeptical about what you read in the newspaper, and you have to take everything with tongue-in-cheek a bit. You know, I think my experience has been mostly just trying to deal with real people. And, you know, I try to create characters in the story that are real, ordinary people who are acting like, say, small heroes by behaving nobly under often extreme circumstances.
Do you get together with other authors in your community when you were living in Kern County or are now on the Central Coast? Is there sort of a writer's circle or writer's workshop that you connect with, or is it more of a solitary experience?
Well, the first thing I'd say is your use of the word author. I always like what Steinbeck said. He said, I'm not an author, I'm a writer. I don't think of myself as an author. I write. And as far as dealing with people here in Monterey County, I have been talking with a local NPR station here, pointing out that they've never done anything as what I think is as thorough as your stations have done in exploring the writings of their local writers. There are hundreds of writers in the Monterey Bay Area who write without gaining much publicity from local media. And even Steinbeck, when he was a young man, was ignored by the Monterey County. And only when he became famous did they ask him to come back and help promote Monterey. And at that point, he refused to ever return. I've not tried to do that. I am trying to organize some local writers and get them together and see if we can't persuade the local media to start realizing they've got a lot of writers and that they should be paying attention to what they're saying and listening to it and reacting and interacting with them.
Howell, if people want to get a copy of your book, where can they find it and how can they get a hold of you?
Well, the simplest way, and since this is going to be radio, tell them, get a pencil and paper. Just to go to my website, primarily. They can do it at Amazon, but if they go to my website, which is www.howellhurst.com, and that's H-O-W-E-L-L-H-U-R-S-T, just howellhurst.com, it explains completely on there how you can get the books either in a digital format or in a print, or get the printed book.
Again, the book is called I Can't Hear the Drums Anymore, Fragments from Life by Howell Hurst, former Kern County resident. You can find some of the stories featured on Valley Writers Read on our website at kvpr.org as well. And you can find that book on Howell's website. Howell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, I've got to thank you. I appreciate the exposure, and I hope some people are able to come and take a peek at the book.
All right, Howell, thanks so much. And that does it for another Valley Edition. You can send us your comments, find our podcast and audio archives on our website at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.